Okay.
Good afternoon. So, review session, as promised. So, there's two things I want to do here. One is to go over the solutions for assignment 9, and the other is to go through the other is to make up questions. Because okay, so now assignment 9. This is a pretty short assignment, so I think we'll be able to grow this pretty quickly, but ask questions. So friend says you have a loopback mount over SSHFS makes it easy to temporarily share files between users without changing file permissions. What are they talking about here? So all I wanted you to explain was that this is exactly what you did in the tutorial for this assignment. If you SSH to a local machine, you can then, like for example, if you're user student and you SSH via localhost, so you SSH localhost, and the other at localhost, you'll then be logged in as other, and then you can access all the files as other, right? So all you do with SSHFS is if you do the same thing but do with SSHFS, all of a sudden now you can access all of other's files as the student user. So now you can copy files back and forth as if they were all yours. So you don't have to worry about doing any changing ownership or anything like that. You just copy them back and forth. That's all I was trying to get at here. Now, if you did this, if you looked at the permissions, though, SSHFS has a weird thing about it. This is something it inherits from Fuse, which is the owner and group of the files will still appear to be the other user. So you have this weird thing that you look at the files and you go like, okay, they're owned by the user other. I am user student. I'm trying to access these. If I read the permissions, it looks like I shouldn't have access. I'm the user student. And these can only be read by the other user. But you could access them all. But only at the mount point. And if instead you go manually to the home directory of the other user, you can access. Then the permissions all apply. It just so happens that SSHFS fills in the user ID and the group ID on the remote system locally. So on my desktop, if I do an SSHFS to the SCS systems and mount it locally, the user ID for my files is like 40,000 something. It's 41,000 something. It just shows the number because, of course, on my system, I don't have any users with that user ID number. So I just see these numbers. Okay, that's all weird, but I can access the files fine. Because, of course, the decision of whether I can access the files or not is made on the remote system. Permissions are enforced in the remote system, not locally. So that's what I was looking for you to explain in this. Questions? Crystal clear? Confusing? Moving on. Question 2. How do processes find out that an authentication agent, SSH agent or similar, is running and will accept connections from them? How would you expect this information to be propagated between applications? How do we propagate information, configuration type information, the setup of the environment to different processes? We use environment variables. That's what they're there for. So the way that the authentication agent, way processes know about it is that there's an environment variable defined when you log in. That's SSH auth soc. So if you look in your environment. The way I was looking for you to look at this is just do an env and grep for something SSH in it. Yes?
I said for that question that the SSH agent was in fact listening on a TCP port breakout connection.
Right.
And that's how it determined.
No, so it's listening on a TCP/IP port, but it's listening on an ephemeral port.
Right.
It's listening on an ephemeral port. It's not a well-known port. It's just listening on some numbered port.
Okay.
There's no way for other processes to know. Actually, it's not listening. It's actually listening on a I think a domain socket, not a TCP socket. But whatever the case is, there's different implementations. The fact is, there's no standard place to go for an agent. And the reason there's no standard place to go for an agent is because it's per user. And you can have multiple users logged into the same computer. And each user can have their own authentication agent. So if there's just one port for them to listen on, then that wouldn't work. So that's why an environment variable is defined for it to find out. And the way that the authentication agent won't necessarily give out authentication credentials to any process that connects to that socket. It'll actually only do it to its children, typically, things that are part of the same process group. This is an additional security measure. Again, with multiple users being on the same system, you don't want them having free range to access the same authentication agent. So the way I was thinking of you trying to solve this was, first of all, you look at the documentation of SSH agent and see how it talks about things. And there's something about environment variables or something there. But the other way of doing it is thinking, okay, there's a process running. It has to have some information about its context in order to do this, as it notes by default. How do we pass along configuration information, like what the terminal's like, what the username is, the username can all be, by the way, but the home directory, there's all this stuff that's set up for processes in environment variables. So I thought, look at the environment variables. Maybe there's one for this. How would you find it? You just run M, we covered earlier this semester, and grep for SSH, all caps. There it is. So there are a couple of paths for doing that, but I would like you at the end of this class to be able to say, oh, I don't know how something works. Rather than just looking up the documentation, you can also should be able to do a little bit of poking around to see what's happening. So can SSHFS directly control file name to inode mappings on the remote system that is being mounted? The proper way to interpret this question is, can you ever control what inodes are associated with the file name? No, it's internal to the kernel. It's its own thing. It's below the level at which user space processes deal with file systems. User space things deal with file names. Inode is internal to the kernel. So you can indirectly influence inode mappings by doing hard links. And you can see what inodes are associated with the file, but you can't do anything with that information. So this is a no, and that's kind of the explanation I wanted you to give. And so the way you could have figured this out is if you were looking at the inode numbers on the local machine and the remote machine tutorial, and you saw they had nothing to do with each other. Completely fictitious. That should give you an idea that it's just making stuff up. And you might say, why is it making stuff up? Well, it's providing a file system-like interface. So it has to provide the stat call. If you're providing stat, it's a struct. It's got a field for the inode number. Got to put something there. So it does. So that's 3 for 4. How many background processes does mounting a remote file system or SSHFS create on the client? And what does each of them do? Creates two processes. One is the SSHFS process, which is doing all the fuse mapping stuff. And the other one is the SSH process, which takes care of the communication with the remote system. You always have to have one process to do the fuse thing. That's what it means to have a user space server. If it's not running, if that dies, then you have nothing powering the file system. But then SSHFS also needs to communicate with the remote system. This could be built into the process, but the easiest way to do this is just to have it use the existing SSH binary. Now, I didn't have you talk about the processes in a remote system because they're a bit complicated, because the SSH daemon runs multiple processes in order to minimize the privileges of each process. So SSH goes to a lot of trouble not to have user input processed and handled in a process that has root access.
because you have to have the initial SSH daemon has to run with root access because it has to be able to become any user. But you don't want that process dealing with all the crazy crypto calculations because you can make a mistake. And in fact, older versions of SSH had mistakes in that code, and people would exploit it, and then they would take over the system. So if you sometimes look at the processes that are spawned on the remote side, you'll see, well, there's all these processes. This question was easier to figure out if you actually did SSHFS to the SCS systems, as opposed to doing it just in a local system. If you do it to the local system, you see the client and server processes at the same time. And that's very confusing. So if you kill the SSH-related processes on the server without touching those in the client with the file system mounted via SSHFS, what happens to that file system? Why? It gets automatically unmounted. It goes away. Because the remote because if any of the processes on the server get killed, all of them die because they notice, hey, my buddy isn't there, and they all terminate. And that then sends a kill. Well, the client side notices, oh, my connection to the SSH died. When it does, it says, oh, I better clean up. And it nicely unmounts the file system.
Yes?
I
actually didn't see that.
Well, if you're in the directory, it'll still be there. That's the thing. So the moment you, so that's the one thing is that it will unmount the file system. Except that if you're already in a directory, you'll still be there, but you can't see anything. It says it'll start giving you errors about remote, remote side not connected. I forget exactly what the message is. But if you cd out of it, like just cd to your home directory, you'll see that, oh wow, now it's gone. And the reason why is SSHFS, it's pretty well built, is meant for production use. And so they've done the case, the remote connection went away, so let me do the error handling and clean up things on this side. There's no point in leaving it mounted if the other side's gone. You want it just to disappear. So that was it for this one. Any more questions about this, or can we start doing questions for the final? Okay. So the strategy is that the best way to understand any final exam, any class, is to try making up questions that you expect to see on the final exam and then see if you can answer them. The reason why this is a good process in general is because if you have to ask the questions, you have to have an idea of what in the world the instructor is trying to teach you and is trying to evaluate. And understanding that can guide your studying. And then if you come up with a question or come up with a variation, you go like, wow, I don't understand that completely. Now you have a direction for studying. Or if you go like, wow, I don't know how to make up a question on this, you probably don't understand the concepts behind that question otherwise. So I've made this strategy relatively straightforward because I've said that the final exam is based on the tutorials and specifically the assignments. So you can follow my algorithm pretty simply. All you do is you go to the assignments, and you start talking about, okay, well, how do I make this into? First, let me go back here. I want to start another scroll wheel on this mouse. It's a little flaky. That, and then we'll start with assignment 6. So remember, the final exam is cumulative. So there'll be questions from the midterm as well as from the final. So you should do this exercise for the entire semester, and you actually have a way of calibrating what kind of questions, because you see what I came up with in the midterm. So of course, take the midterm questions as the first thing, but then I'll say, okay, given those midterm questions, what questions will we have in the final? They won't necessarily want to ask exactly the same questions, but I potentially want to test roughly the same concepts. Yes? I want to try making it balanced. I think there's going to be a good amount of stuff from before the midterm. I expect it to be about half and half. Maybe even a little more on the first half than the second half. I mean, there's going to be a lot of stuff. It's because there's... It's hard to
it's hard to say that explicitly because the nature of this class is cumulative. So what a lot of the questions may end up being is focused on something from the second half, but bringing in concepts from the first. So let's talk about those kind of questions. Now, one thing in general I do try to do with the questions is I want to make sure these are reasonable for you to answer without access to a computer or your references. So some of the questions on the assignments and the tutorials are a bit picky. They ask about very specific details and ask you to explain them, or they ask you to maybe some reference to APIs or something. I don't expect you to have memorized all that stuff. It's a waste of your time and a waste of my time. If you normally would look it up, I would want you to look it up. But so I will try to word the questions so that it gives you maybe hints so that you can work it out. So for example, I wouldn't necessarily want, let's say there's the rsync command. Rsync has a lot of weird flags. I could sit there and ask you, what does the A flag do for rsync? That would require, in order to answer that, you have to have memorized exactly what the flags are of rsync. Annoying. Now, I do expect you to have an idea what the command rsync does. And so what I might do is say, to ask a question about rsync and then prompt you a bit. Say, rsync is used to synchronize the files between two locations. And then ask something about how it operates. So just in terms of how you're thinking about questions, I want to make questions that should be relatively specific, but draw upon your knowledge in a conceptual way, not in a, did you memorize this? So in other words, like if, as you probably realize after going through the midterm, if you went around memorizing answers to the assignments and tried using those answers in the final, you did not do well. So don't do that, please. Let's look here. Okay, great. So this part A was more from the tutorial. So here's this dd command. What's the logical size of the file? How much space does it consume on disk? There's something for making the file system. What command do you run to check the file system for errors? There's all this stuff about file systems. You know, run mount, run df. So what do I want to ask about? What do I care about here? File hierarchy, certainly that's implicitly in there. You have to understand some of the files. File sizes, right? File sizes versus the space used on disk. Right? That's the key. That's what all these things are. It's like how much space is there on disk? Right before they discuss. So run the command truncate. So first off, you're going like, okay, let's make concepts. What are concepts covered in assignment 6? So one is file sizes, logical, walk. What next?
How mounting works.
Okay, so when we say how mounting works, we're talking about the concept of mounting a file system. So when we talk about mounting a file system, that's a bit vague.
Right. What is it about mounting a file system that we really care about? Things like... Is this big enough, by the way? Can you see this in the back? So changes in the file system hierarchy. Maybe the concept of a root file system. Okay, what else we got going on here? We've got loopback mounts and files.
That was another key thing, that you had these files that you mounted.
That's not this assignment. So I'm just focusing on this assignment first. Because that's what you should do, is you go through each assignment and abstract away what you see. So, oh yes, now there is. You all understand holes in files? Holes in files have to do with this. Holes are what allow you to have a logical size that's larger than the physical size. A lot larger than the physical size of the disk, of the file in question. Because remember, you did this truncate command. How big was the file in terms of space consumed on disk? How many blocks did it consume? Like nothing. The usage was zero. Yet the file said it had a logical length of 1 gigabyte. That should seem kind of weird. So the concept that explains this is this notion of holes. Where do holes come from? You know, we talk about this, so what does things like truncate do? So the key idea of truncate and talking about holes is to realize a problem or a feature of the API of files. You have a file of a given length. Can you do a seek? Is your seek limited by the length of the file? No. Turns out in Unix, you can seek to any position in the file, beyond the file, in fact. You can have a zero length file and then seek to 1 gig, and then write to the file. So now you have this weird situation. Okay, I just seeked past this whole, this whole link, and then I wrote data. How does the file system handle that? Does it just, oh wow, you seek to 1 gig, so I better allocate 1 gigabyte of storage and then write some bytes? No. Why bother? That's a waste. We never write anything there. So in the Unix world, you just go ahead and do the seek, and you remember that you seek this many bytes. And you remember that gap as a hole in the file. What happens when you read a hole? Zeros. They're all zeros. No bytes. What happens if you copy the file naively? If you copy the file naively,
you'll fill in the hole and you'll actually allocate the bytes. If you write that portion of the file, you'll get bytes in there. You'll allocate the blocks as you need them. This was the point of all this whole exercise. This was actually one of the big concepts I was trying to get you to see was, oh, look, you do these weird things with files, and all of a sudden, you get the logical size and the physical size get completely out of whack. And that's because you get out holes. Clear? No. Wait, what? What is a node truncate?
You initially talked about the truncate portion.
Yep.
That makes holes, right?
What this does is, what truncate does is it creates a file. Well, strictly speaking, what it does is it truncates a file to a certain length. So if your file was larger than that length, it would discard everything after that point.
And node truncate.
Hmm? Is there a node truncate?
Yeah, of course.
Oh, yes. Oh, right. Yes, the option to DD. Yes. So this is saying overwrite the beginning part of the file and do not truncate it. Because if you didn't put this in there, it would make the end of the file be the end of the write. It would throw away all the rest. So holes. So and then there's this notion of stat. And that was this question, and then... What? It's on the wiki. I'm not planning on deleting it, but I will save it right now, just to make sure. So, let's now turn these into questions. I didn't explicitly ask you about holes in terms of, I think they were kind of behind there, but that was the concept that I was trying to get at. I was trying to get at in a more operational sense. So what if I ask something like, how about this? What would you expect else? So you see how this is kind of in line with what we have. So the question is, if a program seeks on a zero-length file to position 100,000 and then writes one byte, what would you expect the file's logical length to be? What about its physical size? Space consumed by this. So you see how this question relates to the things. This, what does this cover? This covers holes in files. It covers file sizes, logical versus blocks consumed. So, what's the answer to this question?
Logical size is
100,000. 100,000.
Why?
Because you seek to position... Well, wait a second. Let me take that back. You seek to position 100,000. And then you write one byte.
Are you writing that one byte within the space?
No, that's normally... I mean, it should be after that. So I would probably give credit for saying, I would, to be sure exactly what would happen, I would probably have to run the API or something. So I'd expect you to say either 100,000 or 100,000 and what. And if you, and for you to explain which way, that's the logical way. What would you expect the physical size to be? One byte? One block. You expect to consume one block of this. See, this is very... It would not consume one byte on this because files can't have a minimum size of one byte. They can have a minimum size of one block. And that size of the block depends on the blocks. You know, to answer this fully, you would say what based on the... how much space it would consume would depend upon the size of blocks in the file system. So if the file system had 4K blocks, it would take up 4K. If it had 8K blocks, it would take up 8K. So I'd probably give you credit if you say it would took up 4K on disk, because that was the block size we saw. But the proper answer would be to say it consumes one block, and that one block is whatever the block size is of the file system, which is generally 4K. That's a common one. I mean, if you look at they can be all kinds of block sizes, but Unix, EXT4, 4K. I'm not sure what NTFS defaults to now. It might be like 16K. Sure. That's what you were using as EXT4. I'm not going to ask probably specific things about EXT4 as a specific file system because I didn't really talk about it specifically. We're talking about file systems in general. We use a specific one. But all these things basically apply also to things like NTFS. So partially I want you to see the question, and that question is of use. But more importantly, I want you to see the process. Because if you go through this process yourself, this is what you should be doing for studying, rather than rereading your notes, or rereading, or listening, just listening to the lectures, or just rereading the textbook. Don't waste your time with that. I'm saying make up questions. Make up questions and attempt to answer them. That's what you want to do. And the way you make up the questions is look at the assignments, try to figure out what the concepts that are being covered there, and then try to make up questions that cover those same concepts. Because if you do that, then you can kind of go like, okay, if I don't know what the concepts are here, then you go back and say, okay, well, look at the textbook, look at the lectures, and see what are the big ideas that are related to this. And then once you come up with some sort of question, you go like, okay, wait, I don't know about that. And then you have a direction for studying. I'm not saying don't refer to your notes, or don't refer to the lecture audio, or refer to the textbook. You should refer to those, but only after you have a reason to. Has anyone ever told you about this before for studying? No, this whole idea of making up questions as a strategy for studying for exams. I'm assuming this isn't the first time you've heard this.
Well, in this case, we have to fix this again.
But you almost always have something to go on with this. But even if you don't have this sort of thing, you always have something. You have whatever materials you have. You have the lectures, your notes, textbook. There's something that's talking about the concepts. And almost always, that's what testing is designed around. We can't get you to give a full explanation of all of the concepts and how they all connect. But what we can do is say, okay, there's this concept that I was trying to explain, and I gave these examples, so I'm going to try seeing if they understand it by asking something close to that. The goal is not to trip you up, but rather to show that you actually understand it in a non-trivial way. I don't want to see that you can just regurgitate what I told you before. That's not a learning objective of this course. So other concepts. Loopback mounts and files. I don't have a question about loopback mounts. We're not in Fuse yet. Although you can, one thing you can realize is that maybe the questions will span assignments. There's no requirement that the questions have to be specific to a particular assignment. So you might want to try a company. But it's always good first to try to ask questions in more isolated things, then try to then chunk them up and look at things that connect between them. So there's loopback mounts. Remember dev loop zero? That's not open network. Whenever you talk about a loopback is a general term for the computer talking to itself, going around doing this thing to itself. There's loopback over the network. There's also loopback in the file system. And with SSHFS, when we talk about the loopback mounting, it's kind of this weird thing that the network and the file system. We're doing a mount, a file system mount, using the loopback interface of the network to access other parts of the file system locally. So that's why I had that. That's specifically why when I worded that question, I said a friend said this. The reason why I said a friend said this was because it's not quite accurate what that question is saying. The whole idea of a loopback mount, it's not quite a loopback mount in the way we've been saying. It's actually this little, what they're talking about is, you can SSH the same system and mount another user's directory in your account and then access those files as if they're in your own. Loopback part is that you're connecting to the same system of the local network, but then you're also doing this. Yeah, exactly. You're mounting another user's files into your account. Yeah, they're still there also. So there's just two places. And that's a thing. Yeah. So, loopback mounts. SSH connects over networks. The idea of the loopback interface means you can connect over the network to the computer itself. That's the point of the loopback. The whole point is that every computer always has the address 127.0.0.1, which is normally aliases local. So you can always connect to any network service that's provided to other computers. You can access them locally by just connecting to that interface. Because you might not know what the host name or the IP address or whatever of your current computer is, but you can still always talk to those services because, localhost IP address. Again, this is the whole, this loop back just means you're taking something and then somehow turning it back around into the system. It's not a network thing. It's a mapping thing. What you're almost always doing is you're taking part of the system and doing a translation to make it act like another part of the system, which you normally would expect to be somewhere else. Normally you do mounts of specific devices. with a loopback mount, you have one device mounted, and you're going to mount it again. It does, except it's very useful. Because the thing you're mounting again is a file containing a file system. This is how you can access the files in a CD image. You downloaded a CD image, you want to access the files that are in the CD image, you loopback mount it. Now I can access all those files. If you don't loopback mount it, now you could access all that data. It's all there in the file. I mean, all you're doing by a loopback mount is using the file system parsers that are inside of the kernel to parse this file. It's a data structure. So, well, not only are you using the kernel's things to parse it, but now you can also use the kernel APIs, file APIs, to access the contents of that file, the parsed contents. Similarly, you have two processes talking. When you do a loop, kind of this loopback connection over the loopback interface, what you're really talking about is two processes on the same computer talking to each other. Could they have talked to each other in other ways? Yes, they could have talked to each other by sharing a file. They could have talked to each other by sharing memory. It's all these things. But now they're talking to each other by pretending as if they were on two different computers. Right? That's what's going through the loopback interface is. You're doing inter-process communication between two processes as if they were on two separate computers. This is interesting. I hadn't actually taught loopback. I think when I teach this material next time, I'll be careful to distinguish between loopback mounts and the loopback network interface. I didn't think of, and those are two very different things. And they didn't, of course, they're not confusing to me. So. But I hadn't actually taught those explicitly, so because I hadn't done covered things like FUSE before. I like covering FUSE, but I have to be careful about that. So I'll try to keep it, when I ask questions about this, I'll try to make sure it's clear from the context what I'm actually asking about. You know, allows you to connect to a network service. The reason why you're getting the mounting thing in there, the loopback network interface, is because you can do things with the SSHFS. Which is mounting over a network connection. SSHFS is designed to mount something from a remote system. Using a network connection to a remote system to mount the files on a remote system. But since you have this thing called the loopback network interface, and you could have an SSH daemon running locally, you could use the same thing that you would use to connect to a remote machine to connect to your local machine. And it allows you to use some weird Twitter. So, if you understand what's happening with that, you understand a couple of interrelated concepts relatively well. If it's fuzzy to you, my advice is to work on it. The way you work on it first is by playing with it. See, it's not just this abstract thing. It's a concrete implementation. You have these virtual machines. You have these Linux machines. Make them do stuff. See what they do. And going like, okay, I think if I do this, I'll see this happen. And if all of a sudden it surprises you, you're misunderstanding something. So, when in doubt, start getting on a computer and try, I think this is what should happen. Is this actually what happened? That's the point of the tutorial style. Well, that's what I'm asking you. So I could ask, what's the purpose of loopback mounting? But that's a very open-ended question, which could lead to lots of variation in answers. I want to have something a little more specific about loopback mounting. So one thing I could say is that remember, there's the loop devices. So part of this is also
So how about this?
Not giving me anything here.
Download. Only want one file. One way to get that file would be to burn the CD.
So, what's this question say? You download a CD image, but you only want one file that is on the CD. One way to get that file would be to burn the CD and then read the file off of it. How could you get the file without burning a CD?
Note the file is encoded. ISO stands for, actually, International Standards Organization. So that, so this case, it's actually ISO 9660. I'll do that here. It's referred to as CDFS Compact Disk File System by some hardware and software providers. So you download a CD image, but you only want one file that is on the CD. So how would you do this? Yeah. You normally mount, how would you access the files on the CD? You would normally, you say you burn it to the CD, you write it to the CD disk, and then you stick the CD in, and then it would mount the CD, and you could access the file. Here we're saying instead of doing that, do a loopback mount. CD image, and then grab the file. Would I use, do I need a physical CD to do this? No. That's the point of this. You understand what's happening here, you're understanding what's happening with the loopback. Now, if you don't understand this, ask questions. That's it. On older Linux systems, you would have to specify the loopback device to use. You'd actually set, give a dash O and then slash dev, an option loop equals slash dev loop zero or something like that. You'd have to give it a, tell it the loopback device to use. Modern loop, modern mount implementations, if you're trying to mount a file, associate the file with a loopback device automatically. So you can just say mount, file, and then mount.
But you're looking for saying.
No, not necessarily. For this question, the way I've worded this question, you don't have to say a darn thing about loopback. You just say, you can just mean. Whether it's, how can you get the file without burning the CD? You can mount the file directly. That would technically cover it. If I added something into this question of saying, what is the basic term that allows you to do this, or you know, is it? What command would you give for doing this? Does this involve a block device? How about this? Would doing this So while I can't make every question like this, I certainly prefer to ask problem, kind of simple problem-solving questions, where it requires you to integrate the knowledge you have in order to perform, you know, explain something or describe how you perform some concrete task. Because what's the point of taking this class if you can't do that? Yes, you have to get the grade in order to complete your degree, in order to graduate. But the reason we put these little impediments in your way to graduation is because we hope that you get out there in the world and you can actually do something with this knowledge. So, let's go back here to the concepts. So, we've covered loopback mounts, its root. Yes. The block device. Specifically, what is a block device? So this is something you probably want to go and I'll talk briefly about it, but it's something you should probably look up. You know, remember block devices are a type of device file. So you have these. So there's regular files in a Unix system. There's regular directories in a Unix system. Then there's special files. And the special files are ones we talked about are the block devices and the character devices. Character devices are the main difference between the block device and the character devices. Block devices connect into this whole caching infrastructure in the kernel. But the main thing is that the block devices are designed for accessing things like hard disks. Character devices are designed for accessing devices that like anything else. Yeah, exactly. Keyboard. Character device. Yeah, most I/O peripherals you expect are going to be character devices, except for mass storage of some kind. Yes, well, if you're going to mount something, you always have to mount something from, you know, if it's a local mount, it's going to be a block device. Doing a classic, you know, storage-based file system, it's got to be mounting something that's a block device. Then there's network file systems or the fuse file systems. And those are different things. But if you have a storage medium of some kind and you're going to mount it, the way the kernel is going to interpret it is it's going to be a block device associated with that storage medium. Now, in this case, with a loopback device, the storage medium in question is a file on an existing file system. So you have this hard disk, which is represented, say, by dev SDA1, and now you want to mount a file in that file system. That's the loopback thing, because you've got actually two, the kernel is actually going to interpret the same blocks from disk twice. It's going to interpret them first as in the ext4 file system that's on disk, and then a second time as an ISO file system in the file. That's why the whole visual image of the loop is. You're going back through the stack of interpreters inside the kernel. So what were we focusing on here? Does that help explain that block? So the idea is when you mount the ISO file, you can't mount the ISO file directly. It has to be associated with the block device. And then you mount that block. So what about the privileges required? Are many restrictions on mounting file systems? Do you know enough to do that?
Did I tell you about set UID files? I don't think I did. So. Ah.
And so there are many restrictions in mounting file systems, like which users. So if you took away those restrictions, how could you completely change how the system operates? Thoughts? This one's a hard question, but actually, when you see it, it's relatively simple.
Well, this isn't talking about loading devices and things into the kernel, so that can change things. But
if I could mount a file system anywhere from anything, what could I do? How can I make it just a very different system? So, what defines, you'd say, how the program works, you know, how the system works, is defined by the programs and binaries and configuration files, right? How could I change what the program binaries are on a system? Yeah. Nope, but the mounting wouldn't allow you to modify the kernel, at least not directly. I'm saying I can change every program binary on the system. All I'd have to do is create a file with a file system in it, and then copy whatever binaries I wanted into it, and then mount it over /bin. Mount it over /userbin. Mount it over /etc. Which is where all the executables are. Remember the path environment variable? Remember where all the directories, where all the key files are on your system? You could do a mount, and remember, what happens if you mount something over an existing directory? It's all gone. I mean, it's not deleted, but now you're going to access the new things instead of the old thing. So all of a sudden, you've replaced every binary on the system, every configuration file on the system, by some random thing you put in a file. Yes. Break everything. I mean, that's what I'm saying. You could change anything. You could be... Now all of a sudden, you know, up is down, you know, LS, you know, erase your hard disk. I mean, it just changes everything. Yep. Sure. In 1 second, let's see what. The hard links, well, you haven't changed the nature of the hard links, but you've changed the names. Well, hard links where? Yes. If the program's already running, it will still maintain the access. Yes. Very good point. But for any new thing, any new file, it will see things via the new mount points. I'm saying is any files that are open, you keep access to them. Remember, open files, you keep access to the iNode. But let me see if I can... Let me try another. So... when you run the mount command, what happens? You take the files that are in a file system and make them appear at a certain place in the file system hierarchy. So, for example, we have slash, this goes to /home, goes to... you know, you have all these directories at home, then you have student. Here's also. I'm not drawing this correctly here. Is it really, sir?
You have your slash directory. Slash has various things in it, like home, etsy, user.
User, there'll be a directory. Bin.
So this is just the directory hierarchy. This is clear, right? So we normally you do a mount.
You say you have a directory called MNT.
And you'd have some device, like a USB stick or something, that has a file system on it. You'd mount it. And it would appear all the files on that USB stick now are here. And now that appears there. And then the moment you unmount it, this would disappear, and these files aren't there. Now, the restrictions on a typical Linux system is that you can only do this. Like, a USB stick would actually normally show up under /media/ and the username, and only allow things to be mounted there. What I'm saying is, what if I could instead mount this anywhere? If I can mount this anywhere, that means this homework now could all of a sudden be put over here, blowing away whatever else was there. And let's see, now I have the file /etsy/homework. No, there are restrictions. This is not allowed. It will say permission denied. I mean, if you're root, you can do it. Root can do whatever they want. But I mean, but you can do this fundamentally will change how your system's operating, because all of a sudden you've taken these random other files and now made them overlay parts of your file system. Yeah, but I'm saying the file system could be a loopback file system. So it could be something in a file system that you created in a file. You don't need an external device. It could just be. It's. A file system is just a hierarchy of files. You're just putting that hierarchy over bin. Exactly. It's just an overlay. Well, unmount wouldn't mean the mounting and unmounting doesn't change the underlying file system. There's nothing to corrupt it. Well, yeah, your system's completely messed up. I mean, you completely messed up. That's why normally it won't let you do these kind of things. You don't let, it doesn't let you play stupid tricks with mounting. Now, of course, there actually have been Unix variants, things like Plan 9, where every process can do unrestricted mounting, but the mounting it does is only visible to itself. So any process could decide, oh, I'm going to make /bin something else and point to this other directory and stuff. But it only sees it. In Unix systems, there's only one view of the file system. When you mount something, you mount it for everyone. So it's a very powerful command. Yeah, well, you're saying if it did a per process view, you're saying? Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's only it's changed its own view of the world. No one else affects. I mean, basically, it's like it's gone a little crazy. It's thinking that okay, flowers are off in the corner there. It sees the flowers that are growing there. There's no flowers there, but it thinks there's flowers there. No one else is paying attention. With mounting, you can actually like all of a sudden now everyone sees the flowers. Plan 9. Yes. Yes, it's overlaid. The old files. No, it's bad because now any part of the system accessing the configuration, like for example, Etsy contains the password file, which defines all the users and all the passwords. So now all of a sudden you create a whole new set of users and passwords, or maybe there's not even a password file at all. Now the system has no accounts. I mean, you're the new one. Polarity issue. It's just craziness. So, well, I would be looking for you to describe something like mounting. Now, this I wouldn't want to ask a question just like this because it's a little broad. I would want to make it a little easier for you. I want to give you a few more hints. But for making something up like here and thinking about it, trying to integrate the questions, this is it's good to think about these sort of harder questions because they force you to really think about how these things fit together.
So would you say, like, what would happen?
Well, I mean, we could work on wordsmithing it to make it less restrictive, but I'm not going to do that right now. Just real quick, it's been an hour and 10 minutes already. I can go for, you know, another 20 minutes or so, but before I continue, I was thinking you guys might want me to, I was going to plan on having some office hours the rest of the week. So I can do office hours Wednesday through Friday. I just don't know what time.
Afternoons is good. So let's see. I've got, so tomorrow I have my normal office hours 1 to 3 tomorrow. And then Thursday, how about Thursday 1 to 2:30? And Friday the same? Is 1 o'clock kind of a good time, you know? Okay, so I'm not going to do office hours on Saturday. But I will do them. So I'll post a message, basically. I'll do 1 to 3 tomorrow and 1 to 2:30 Thursday and Friday. No, I'm saying I have office hours. You can come to my office and talk if you have questions. So I can continue with this, but this is kind of a slow process going through this and stuff. So I'd rather now focus on some specific questions that you all have on, like, something that makes sense or something. Yep. Any questions? I haven't finished making up yet, so I can't say, but it's going to be, I think, roughly double the questions of the midterm. I'll have to see how long it shows up. I may make it like 1.5 times. I said, however long the midterm is, like I think roughly twice as long. I don't recall any of you having trouble finishing the midterm. You didn't code in the midterm. You don't have to code in the final. I thought about that. I'm not going to. I'm not going to have you. I didn't ask you assembly on the midterm. Assembly was a means to an end. You can try to understand the concepts. Not to say I couldn't ask you all kinds of fun questions about the assembly. I'm going to follow the same style that I've done with the midterm. Continue on for the last few assignments.
I haven't checked yet, but yesterday I realized.
Yeah, so assignment 8 is posted. All the other assignments now are in audio form.
Yeah.
And I'm going to be putting up for the next day or so. So I just wanted to make sure I get them good. But also, I kind of dual things. One is taking the time to do it. But the other thing is I don't actually want you focusing too much on the answer. I want to give them so you can kind of check your conceptual knowledge, but actually, if you're worrying too much about the solutions, that's a bit of a problem.
But they help us.
I'm happy to, but the point is it helps you understand this much. And the reason why I wanted more talk about them is because then you can kind of see the context. Because I'm not going to ask you in general exactly that. So if you study that and you understand this, and then I move over a little bit and I ask this, about, well, hey, that wasn't on the assignment.
Yeah.
Yes, but that's why we talk about it. I talk about all the assignments. I've talked about all the assignments. I've talked about all the answers.
This.
Yeah, but it's
make up your own questions. There's nothing, this is not a math course. It's not, there's not this, you're not going to have answers. You go like, is that right or is that not right?
I mean, where you're going to come up with problems is realize that you have a completely messed up understanding of how things work. And in general, what I tend to notice is not that people have completely messed up understandings that they're completely competent. It's more like, I don't know what the heck's happening. People generally know that they're confused, that their mental model is not complete, and that when you actually know what's going on, you're pretty confident. You go like, okay, yeah, that's going to happen. This is going to happen. And you go like, I got this basic idea. So you have to push forward on that confidence thing, trying to say, okay, what is it I don't get? So I'm asking from you a bit more than maybe in a lot of other courses in terms of how you're supposed to approach the material, but it's like, I want you to be able to leave this course and when you encounter things involving operating systems or other large software systems, I don't want you to sit there going, no one told me how to deal with that. I want you to be able to figure it out. Yeah. Distributed operating system next term. That's reading a research paper. Yeah. If you're interested in taking distributed operating systems, please do. But, you know, I'd only suggest it if you're really interested in this material because the whole semester is reading research papers on operating systems with these concepts flying all over the place. So it's great stuff, but, yeah. You should be somewhat comfortable with the basic Linux commands because I might use them, but I'll use them as vocabulary. Now, I'm not going to be testing you on specific Linux commands, but they may all come up. Like, I'm going to ask you about FSCK or something. I'm not asking you, what is that command? I'm asking you, okay, what is this checking a file system kind of thing? If you've been doing the tutorials and the assignments, you are familiar with the commands. If you haven't been doing them, you're going to have problems. Yeah, this is how I started off the tutorial, saying this is how you should study the test. So, make up questions. Try to figure out the answers. If you don't understand some things, talk with your friends. Try to look it up. Come see me. Any other specific questions? Don't panic. If you go in with the right attitude and you've been doing the work up to this point, you're probably going to pass. The reason why I say I can't say for sure because I don't know what you're going to do. But I'm saying is that you're in much better shape now than you were at the midterm. You should feel much more comfortable with the material than you did at the midterm because the same material has been all this stuff for file systems should be reinforcing the other thing. But if you're having difficulty, come see me. I could ask the TAs to also have some office hours. But I was kind of thinking that they have other stuff. Yeah, exactly. That's what they have to do. They got behind on that. They were supposed to get them done earlier. So, but those should all be graded before the final. So you should get them by Friday. So at least you can know where you stand. But again, your grade is not going to be lowered by your assignments. That's kind of one of the basic things. Your grade will be lowered by your midterm and final, but your grade's not going to be lowered by your assignments and tutorials. And I make sure of that when I do calculate your grades, because that's just silly. Do I bell curve it?
Like,
Not normally. I have an implicit bell curve built into the course. A built-in curve built into the grading scheme. Because you basically should have 100% for your tutorials. And your assignments should, in general, be pretty good, too, because you have time to do them. And I drop the lowest ones for both. So those are designed to boost 40% of your grade up. So 60% of your grade from the midterm final, you know, it will bring it down some, but then hopefully it balances out. So that's how I try to build in. So I don't normally change. I might do like a 1 point kind of thing. Like I sometimes do a little, but that's more to like adjust people that are on the borderline. I really hate it when people are like, okay, you're right at C+, and there's like 1 point difference. I'm gonna give you the B- normally because that's grading error in there. I can't distinguish between those two things. So I'll round up, but I'll put it this way: in all my years of teaching this course, I've never had to do a significant curve. Because normally people's grades come out very consistently and it all comes out to a nice bell curve already. And I've got plenty of A's and plenty of B's. People don't fail my classes normally unless they just haven't been paying attention. So. I can't say whether you can get, if you've been paying attention, but well, if you've been kind of doing a job, people do get C's and D's and stuff. The people who fail, they just haven't been doing the work. So, okay. Good luck. See you Sunday. It's all about the